Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1999, includes the late Lloyd Mott, Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at Columbia University, and late broadcaster Hugh Downs discussing the essentials of astronomy. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Lloyd, I remember, I think it was 2 years ago that we celebrated your 60th year of teaching at Columbia. It's 62 years ago now.
That's right, yes.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, I began at City College and came over here at the time because I became involved with I. Robbie, who was a great professor here, and he brought me over to Columbia, and I got my PhD with Robbie.
Right.
From that time on, I felt I have my foot in the door, so to speak. And so I began to teach courses at Columbia. And as it happens, my son Robin was my assistant, who is now professor of medicine up at Presbyterian. So I had a wonderful time. And as a matter of fact, one of my students was the wife of the dean, Dean Hacker at the time, and his sons and so on. So I got to know everyone.
And you knew the heavy hitters of that time, too, didn't you?
Yes.
I remember your tales of Julian Schwinger.
Julian Schwinger. He was a phenomenon.
Yeah.
He was one of the wunderkinder that you rarely meet. He and Feynman, they were sort of competitive. Schwinger was at City College, and he was a student of mine. He came in from Townsend Harris, and he attached himself to me. I remember Julian was offered a spot at Columbia, so I went in to see the chairman of physics at City College, Corcoran. And I said, I think we should give Julian Schwinger honors, he said, over my dead body. He doesn't have any homework and so on, because Julian used to sleep all day and go.
He wouldn't come onto campus even, did he?
So he said, I'll go to Columbia. And Columbia. There's a famous paradox known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox.
Yes.
And I spoke to Julian. I said, Julian, he came and explained it to Robbie. Robbie almost dropped dead.
Is that right?
Really? He said, this kid.
He was a student.
So I said, Julian, will you come to Columbia? He said, again, I'll come if I can't get honors at City College. And so on.
Marvelous. In the time that you've been studying this and teaching at Columbia, you've seen a lot of changes in advanced theoretical physics. And some of them I know you feel are advances,
well,
and some you think are going to go down the tube.
You see, if you go back to the time of Newton, that was theoretical physics also.
Yeah.
And the basic formulas, F equals ma, force equals mass times acceleration. But what are the forces? What's a force?
Yeah.
So the big problem in physics in the last number of years was trying to determine the forces. Which forces exist? Where are they?
Yeah.
You see. And so this is what led to the notion of particle physics, all kinds of particles and so on, groups of particles. And I've discarded that idea and I said, I'm not interested in a particle that lasts for 10 to the minus 20th seconds, which is, I want to know what the universe is like now. And I have gone back to the notion that gravity is the basic force, and I've introduced a structure I call a uniton.
I remember you talking about
which that. I associate with what Gell-Mann called quarks, Q-U-A-R-K. That's the end.
Yeah.
So it's a very funny thing. The word quark came from
I think it was James Joyce.
Four quarks from Muster Mark or something of that sort, I don't know.
That was in Finnegan's Wake, I'm
Finnegan's,
pretty sure.
Yeah, Finnegan's Wake.
A lot of these names have come from strange sources. Tell me this, I remember since I was a student in a class of yours at Columbia, where the steady state theory was fairly entrenched, and that's been replaced by the concept of a Big Bang.
Yes, well, the steady state is difficult because it's difficult to understand how under the force of gravity anything can be steady. See, so that
yeah.
It gave it. But Einstein introduced a term to prevent the universe from collapsing. He thought it was steady.
Mm-hmm.
See. But with Hubble's discovery of the expansion, Einstein considered that term he introduced to keep everything steady the biggest error he ever made. Now people are coming back to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, didn't he at one time call that the biggest mistake of his career?
And as a matter of fact, we watch the universe and its expansion. It seems to be speeding up.
Do you believe that? I mean, some people, Sandage believes that that might be spurious on grounds that one, the type 1A supernovae that are...
Yes, they're different.
There may be, we're looking back into the past considerably,
sure,
and they may not have developed the elements up to iron, and so it might not be the standard candle that, had been thought.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
Sandage, in my book, An Essentials of Astronomy, I paid a lot of attention to what Sandage is because he developed very cleverly the evolution of the sun. Mm-hmm. The question is, how is the sun going to evolve? Well, it will evolve steadily, that is, sending out radiation, but in time, it's got to stop. It uses up its fuel.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going to happen? It's going to send out radiation more and more from regions further and further away from the center, right? And therefore, it has to expand in a sense. And so the sun is going to become what we call a red giant, a huge star, and then ultimately become a white dwarf, sink down to nothing, and what will happen to everything? So that's the general theory that's been developed.
As a red giant, will it absorb the orbits of Mercury and Venus?
It might, that's right. And I've introduced a sort of fictional story. I said, let's suppose the sun is going to become a red giant, you know. We've got to get out of it. We've got to get out of the orbit. Can we introduce atomic bombs which will push us faster and faster and keep us one step ahead of the oncoming sheriff, so to speak? So I propose that idea now. I know that's a lot of sense.
That's an interesting idea. We have a lot of time to work on that,
I think,
what is it, about 5 billion years down the road?
We believe the sun will last for 5 billion years. That's when it'll use up its fuel.
Sure.
But I don't know. The point is that we can introduce other particles that I have, the uniton, which doesn't use up the point is, if I look at a proton, you know what a proton is?
Yes.
That's an atom. I argue the proton is not a basic particle, but it consists of unitons spinning around particles that are... This was first introduced by Bob Hofstadter. He didn't introduce this idea, but Bob Hofstadter, City College guy who got the Nobel Prize, he died recently, he began to probe protons with neutrons and so on. A neutron can get into nuclei and not be affected. But when it gets into a nucleus, it discovers there's the structure is not as simple as it appears. It's not an elementary particle. And so physicists began to worry about the structure of nuclei.
Does the uniton relate in any way to the quark, which is also...
Yes, I've identified the uniton with a quark.
Right.
You see, there's certain quantities in nature. First, the electron charge. Then there's a number called H, which leads to quantum theory. Yeah. Then there's a speed of light. These numbers govern nature.
Right.
So if you take E squared and divide it by HC, you get a dimensionless number. It's a square of the ratio of the electric charge to the another charge. I then say H bar C is a charge. I call that a gravitational charge. And I said, instead of speaking of mass of gravity, let's speak of charges of gravity. They pull each other together. Gravity always pulls together. It never repels.
Now, does the uniton, is its similarity to a quark mean it takes three of them to make a proton?
Yes, I argue that a proton consists of triplets of these things combined, and they're rotators.
And what's the difference then between a uniton and the concept of a quark?
Well, I identify them.
I've identified them. But you had that idea before.
I got a letter from Gell-Mann about this thing, and he objected to. I said, "What do you suggest in my book?" He said, "Put it all in a footnote." So in the footnote, I developed this whole idea that there are basic particles that I call unitons.
Right.
They're called Planck mass particles, 10 to the minus fifth grams.
Right.
That's a very massive particles, very massive particles, compared to the mass of a proton, 10 to the minus 24th. An order of 10 to the 19th times. In other words, the energy you need to go, it's a complicated picture.
It is complicated. It seems to get more complicated in ways. Do you think that in the near future there'll be any kind of a new theory that will knit some of these things together? I'm thinking of an analogy that when the Ptolemaic idea of epicycles and retrograde motion in orbits vanished as soon as we abandoned the idea of an Earth-centered universe.
Right. Yes.
Will we see something that might do away with this zoo of subatomic particles and simplify things a little? Is that possible?
It will simplify. You see, people have gone into particles, the whole series of particles. For example, if you have enough energy, you can excite a particle, but they have a very short lifetime. Who cares about a particle that lives from 10 to the minus 20 seconds, 10 to the minus 15 seconds, and so on? And a lot of physics has been devoted to that stuff. I don't like it.
Tell me this. How do you feel about the idea that certain constants, if they were different by a tiny fraction, I'm talking about 10 to the 15th, might not have been able to produce a universe that would have the time to develop planets and galaxies and so forth.
That's right.
And life.
You're
and I guess
right.
I'm getting at the anthropic principle. How do you feel about that?
There is a certain principle, that is, if you want to collect things, you have to start with a certain mass. Can this mass grow instead of being dissipated? It's like a crowd of people. Will a crowd grow? In other words, it will grow if it has a certain mass and then can collect other stuff with it.
Oh, yes.
It's the virial theorem, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to the notion that there's dark matter in the universe.
And what's the name of that theorem?
Virial, V-I-R-I-A-L.
Ah, virial.
Virial theorem.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if that's not so, then these things can simply disappear. They won't stay together. But the virial theorem clumps them together, that theorem. They obey the virial theorem, so on.
Now, if some of those constants were different by a tiny amount, you wouldn't have a universe such as
we have. You cannot fool around with that.
Does that mean that the universe then was so constituted as to create complex chemistry and the human brain and the idea of examining the universe?
Well, if you think of the human brain, you see, you have the electrons moving around. They develop, a particle associated with a wave called the de Broglie wave, DBDE, who introduced this idea. So the wave's in your mind all the time. And I've argued that thought means these de Broglie waves. And if you're not a nut or if you're not crazy, then all these waves are, they don't interfere with each other. But if the waves in your mind were to interfere and interrupt your thought, I think you'd go crazy.
Well, so that might be a definition of sanity then.
That's right.
If you don't have, well,
well of course, nobody's going to accept that.
Being sane means being whole, and if you're not fragmented, you're whole. But the idea that the universe appears to be about the business of understanding itself, if the human brain
is. Yes, this is a woman by the name of Virginia Trimble. Do you know her?
I know the name.
Yeah, she's a lovely woman. She introduced this idea of the, principle?
The anthropic?
Yes.
That's right. It seems to me that there's a lot of polarization in connection with the anthropic principle, and some are bitterly opposed to it.
The idea that the universe wants to see itself or understand itself implies the existence of life, and so, but... Oh, you can't argue against it. You can't argue for it. There's no way of proving or disproving it.
Stephen Hawking appears to embrace the idea.
Well, Stephen Hawking became famous because he was concerned with a black hole. Now, what the hell is a black hole?
Yeah, that's a hard one to
People speak about a black hole as though it were really a hole. In fact, there's a big discussion. Suppose you send a dictionary down to a black hole, what would happen to it? It's not a hole in that sense. It is merely matter piling up until it's so massive that light can't get out.
Right.
Then we can't see it, so it's called a black hole. But it's not a hole in that sense.
But you can't, it's not in the same, all of it is not in the same inertial frame that we are right now.
Well,
because you can't go in one side and come out the other side. It just seems to be an infinite hummock.
If you try to go into a black hole, then you'd find yourself going into the future, so to speak, because time would reverse itself at a certain point. It'd be very complicated. So these are things that thing. But in all of these things, Einstein was always sane. He never involved himself in this sort of stuff.
No, he didn't, and he resisted quantum theory, too.
Yes,
and
he did.
He said God doesn't play dice.
That's right. Yes, he doesn't. He didn't like that. He wanted to be precise and so on. So, and the young people who are growing up today, if you go down to the seventh floors where we have coffee, so on, and you meet them all, and I say, well, what are you going to do with your life? I said, all the great theories have been discovered. No new theory will be discovered. Great principles, because if you name any phenomenon in nature to me, I can tell you, I can explain it with a phenomenon, with a basic theory. And they look at me, oh, we're going down to Wall Street. They all want to become rich. It's true.
So you think there isn't, is there an evaporation of the curiosity that we've had that led us into this century with people like Heisenberg?
But the point is, even if there is an evaporation of curiosity, your mind wants to find something that it can pin onto.
Yeah.
And if people are told, if students are told, well, what all the theories are known, they say, well, what are we going to do? I said, we'll go down to Wall Street and make a lot of money. Money, money, money.
Is this a reflection of what Plato once said, that he got so sick of bloodying his head against the stone wall of logic that he came to envy the quiet orthodoxy of Egypt? And I wonder, are we producing a generation that's just kind of tired of looking into things, or will physics move ahead as it has been doing?
We won't know how to look into things. We have all, we cannot develop, in other words, you name a phenomenon that we observe and I can give you the basic theory that'll explain it.
You can answer the how,
yes,
but the why questions are still a problem with physics, aren't they?
I don't even know why life should have arisen on the Earth.
Yeah. Now, is it possible that science, and by that I mean all knowledge, needs to move ahead by taking the step of cranking in the factor of ourselves as subjective investigators, and not just try to think of ourselves as outside and there's an objective truth out there we're going to find out about? Because apparently, and quantum mechanics points this up, that we, as soon as we start trying to investigate something, we alter what we've tried to investigate.
Well, the quantum mechanics arose in this way. There's a single number, H, that's called Planck's constant.
Right.
That number says that if you know the position of a particle with a certain accuracy, you don't know how it's moving.
Yeah.
So there are two the uncertainty relationship, and that the total uncertainty can't be less than H, because H is a number.
And that's a number.
That's right. That's the smallest.
Yeah, maybe it was you that taught me this. That one of the best analogies I know about that was, if you had the information on one side of a microscope slide of the velocity, and the other was the position, you can focus on one, but the other becomes blurred.
Right.
And that seems
but
to be a fact.
There's uncertainty in all our relationships, in all kinds of things. We have people who die, we remember them, but we forget the past. What were they like? You think of your mother, your father, you remember them in a hazy sort of way. So memory itself becomes very deceptive. And we have to accept that.
Uncertainty is all over. But the fact that would show up in as precise a thing as the mathematics of physics is interesting.
Yeah, that's the quantum theory forces that, because it brings in the number H.
Yeah.
And says you can't have anything less than H. That's the smallest.
Yeah.
So everything is governed by that.
Now, does that relate to this idea? The reason there probably was no T0 for the Big Bang, or that the universe came from a singularity, might be that quantum time, or Planck time, of 10 to the minus 43rd second. That to imagine an increment of time smaller than that is meaningless.
Yeah,
is that true?
Now, John Wheeler, with whom I've been very friendly, you know John Wheeler?
Yes.
A wonderful guy. And he tried to introduce the idea that there's, if you go down to an early time, everything is fluctuating and so on, and out of this fluctuation something arose. I don't believe that. The point is, was there a zero moment? It is argued the universe is about 8 billion years old.
Some think upwards of 15.
But 15?
But
give or take a
whatever
minute.
The number.
I mean, it's all a complicated thing, Hugh.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to think about, and that you are able to do this, and also being involved in all the fancy things that are going down in Lincoln Center and so on.
Well,
that's really remarkable to me.
I guess I am an amateur in the sense of the word, that an amateur is a lover of whatever it is. And as you know, I've been interested in this for quite a long time. I remember when I came, if we can inject a personal note, I came about 20 years ago, I came to you with a theory that I had, not a theory, but just an idea that maybe would account for the missing mass. And you pointed out at that time that the flaw in it was I had overlooked the equivalency principle, the E equals MC squared.
Yes.
And when I felt embarrassed about that, and you said I shouldn't be embarrassed because one time Einstein was in an argument with Niels Bohr, and Bohr pointed out that Einstein had forgotten.
Oh, yeah, that was a big famous argument they had, which was written up in a book which I read thoroughly and so on. These are great men. And we say, where do we belong in this category? Obviously, we cannot achieve their greatness anymore. Although we may try, but we have to repeat what they have done. But that's all right. In other words, the basic theories, I have a letter from Dirac in my file. Dirac was one of the great physicists because he introduced a new way of looking at the equation of the electrons and so on. He introduced what are known as matrices and so on. And in this, he argues, Dirac's argument is that you cannot be precise about what's going on, you see. He said, and physicists have tended then to dismiss these things as quite unimportant. He said, some of them may become infinite. He said, we can't. In other words, if you try to locate something very precisely, you get into infinities and so on. So there's difficulties of that sort, he said. So that there's a lot of uncertainty even in our knowledge of the universe.
That bolsters the idea of quantum theory,
yes,
quantum mechanics, doesn't
yes,
it?
That's right.
I always think of this simple thing, again, maybe I got this out of one of your classes, but the idea that in investigating something, you influence what there, and quantum mechanics shows that up, because if you bounce a photon off of an electron, you will know where it was, but you won't know where it is. And this is one of the uncertainties. But the analogy was that if you have a glass of water and want to find out the temperature, you have to insert a thermometer. Mm-hmm. Unless the thermometer, by fantastic coincidence, is exactly the same temperature as the water, which you can't know,
that's right.
You have interfered with what you're trying to find out. Do you think that the science of the future is going to have to crank that in more than it currently does to insert into the equation us as investigators?
Well, that was thought that we have an influence on, and I think Bohr had that idea also. Do we influence what we concept as theories and so on? I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. Because suppose all life disappeared on the Earth. All life disappeared. Would the universe be altered?
Well, it might not. Bishop Berkeley believed that maybe it was mind only that supported the whole idea of the universe, and there isn't anything there really without that. That would be hard to prove or disprove because it gets theological rather than theoretical.
But I've applied my ideas to various other things. I've tried to understand, for example, what's happening to the soil on the Earth. Soil is very precious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's being spoiled by all of junk and so on. I've introduced a way of purifying the soil by mixing it with sodium silicate. And I even demonstrated that. There's a fellow by the name of David Secunda, who was vice president of American Management Associates. They were on 57th Street near Broadway. I got to know him through a Greek by the name of Necronopolis, who happened to be something of a liar. Very interesting. So one day, David Secunda came up to me and said, Lloyd, he said, we have 650 billion barrels of oil in the Athabasca tar sands in Canada. You've heard about those?
Yes, I remember that.
I said, what do you mean by that? I don't know what it is. So he said, do you think you can help us try to get the oil, the sand? I said, well, I don't know. I said, can you bring some of the stuff down to me? It was in my office down on the third, on the right down here, up here. So he brought me a chunk like that. I said, okay, Dave. I said, go downstairs, get me a 10%, get me some sodium, you know what sodium silicate is? It's called water glass. My parents, it's really a combination of sodium and sand. They take sodium, boil it with sand, you get a liquid stuff. And it's very. So I said to him, oh, Dave, do that. I said, get me a wearing, you know what a wearing blender is.
Yes.
So he brought it to my office. I took this chunk, this little piece of this chunk, and put it in and mixed it with the sodium silicate. I pressed the button, you know, a moment. I looked, the oil was on top, water and sand at the bottom. I had separated the oil from the tar sand just like that.
Are they doing that with the Athabasca?
No, they're not doing it because it interferes with Sun Oil Company, which owns all of that stuff.
Oh,
and I went down there once to see them, and they asked me, invited me to come down, and I demonstrated to them what I was doing. They had a bus for me and so on. I went down there, and so I did the same thing. And so I separated that, and there they were cooking something, barreling it for hours. I separated it when they said that you have to boil this stuff, you know, make it hot and so on. And so they had separated it. They held up a test tube with my stuff and their stuff. And we looked at it, and they said to me, well, yours is a little bit turbier than mine, ours. I said, you've been boiling that thing for, what, an hour? I've done it in 3 seconds. I said, how can you compare it? So I knew that they you could never get anywhere with them because they're controlled.
And they don't want to release that.
They don't want to. No, because, you know, it's interesting that if a company, a large, controls something, they don't want to have anyone come in and fool around with them.
Well,
and they want to say, we can't go up to our CEO, chief executive officer, said that two guys came out of the street or somebody and showed us how to say.
You raise an important issue now. If right now we are, as far as we know for sure, the only intelligent life in the universe. That's unlikely, but that's all we know. If we really mess up this planet, that's sort of the end of humans. And as you said, maybe that's not important, but it's important to us. Space travel is an opportunity for extensive reprieve from the limits to growth and the, you know, being on a finite surface of a sphere, where we've got large population numbers and we are in danger of harming our environment. Space travel is probably inevitable, and we may, before too long, get to Mars and the moons of the gas planets and so forth.
Mars, how fast would we have to go?
Well,
it would take us years and years. We'd all get old and so
forth. With new means of propulsion, which may not be too fantastic, we could do it in a relatively shorter time. But my question is this, do you believe that there will be human excursions into space, at least to explore the whole solar system, the possibility of life on some of those moons?
There can be, but if you now consider what happens when you are in space travel,
sure,
the stresses on your body, there are no longer any stresses. Your bones get weak, everything.
Well, they'd have to devise ways of exercising or artificial gravity through centrifugal force or something. But do you think we are a spacefaring species as humans? Do you think that will happen at some point?
I believe that we're the highest evolution of life. The highest evolution of life. And you might say, how are we going to evolve from this point on? We will evolve intellectually. More and more beauty and truth. And why do we enjoy music? Why do we? There is what is known as a pleasure center in the brain. And this was demonstrated by mice. They took experiments, they sent an electrode in the brain of a mouse, and they stimulated his pleasure center, and he had a choice, the mouse, of pressing a button to give him food and pressing a button. He starved to death.
Starved to death because he'd go for the pleasure. Yeah. Yeah.
So pleasure can be very great. And what is meant by love between two people? Why is it? Because presumably nature wants the propagation of the species. Sure. Now this applies to all mammals. I don't know about rattlesnakes or about alligators, how they do. They lay eggs. Then they forget about them altogether, you see.
And yeah, they don't have a relationship. So
they have no relationship to them.
Do you think science will ever really compass the whole meaning of such spiritual concepts as love and that sort of thing? Or is that outside of the scientific realm?
It can't be scientific. It can't be scientific. Now, there's a remarkable situation in the evolution of man and woman. They evolve in such a way that their sexual organs always match, right?
Or we wouldn't be here.
As far as we know. And this is wonderful.
Well, that puts us back to the anthropic principle. Is the universe constituted the way it is so that it could produce a high evolution?
That's a pure guess. Then you'd have to say, what is the purpose of the universe itself? What is the purpose of the earth?
And so on. Yeah, it might be naive to think in terms of purpose. But I think it's just as naive, or just as, certainly it's sterile, to think of it as merely an accident, you know, that there may be a case to be made from design.
It may
be. Without getting
be.
Theological about it.
The point in this is that you are free to develop any idea you want if you do not violate a basic physical principle. And this is Dirac's point of view. Don't be restricted by the fact that somebody is going to object to what you say. Mm-hmm. Let them object all they want.
But as soon as you produce an anomaly by violating logic,
that's right.
that's meaningless.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And that's the way it's going, and I think that's the way it should be.
Right.
And that people can communicate with each other and so on. There are things happening in the universe that, to me, I mean on this earth. For example, soil is being ruined, and I've introduced a way of remediating the soil. If you mix a soil with sodium silicate, you can separate out. In fact, I showed this. I told you, when you get a wetting bladder and so on, you can separate out the dirt from the soil, and you can do that throughout the entire world.
How energy intensive is that?
Usually,
it requires a lot of energy to separate, for example, to separate rust from iron, or to separate to make water potable again. You can always do it, but it takes energy. How much energy does this theory of yours take?
Well, the first thing you do is find a way of doing it. Then, as far as energy goes, we can produce all the energy we want. I've developed a method of this. Suppose we take, we're going to take protons and neutrons and so on and put them into a container and then compress it.
Okay.
They will combine to form helium,
right,
releasing a vast amount of energy. And if you combine them this way, they release, and then a piston will be thrown back to another chamber where more, and then it'll go back and forth, and you'll have all the energy you want forever.
Can you? How much energy does it take to compress them, though? Is that within?
When
our...
you pull it back, of course, it's just a gas,
mm-hmm,
so that the total, it's just the pressure, mm-hmm, which is due to the temperature of the things are moving about. But you can always push it fast enough to compress it. If you push it fast enough to compress and release more energy, then the piston has to go back and go into this chamber. So you can have something which is going back and forth.
I'm sure you've investigated this, so it isn't perpetual motion.
It's practically perpetual
motion. Really?
Yes. Because you get a vast amount of energy. Think of how Fermi introduced the idea of the atomic bomb.
Well, that's true.
I knew Fermi very well. Did a book in thermodynamics with him,
right,
where he pointed out that if this goes back to Zeta Lisa Meitner, that if you separate, if you're able to introduce a slow neutron which separates part of uranium, this piece and that piece, enough, then they push against each other and you get a fission explosion.
And you can produce a chain reaction just by introducing neutrons to a super...
Fermi was under my, down on the seventh floor, on the eighth floor, he was building what is called a pile. Mm-hmm. He had to arrange it so that no neutron get out. It became impossible, and they were afraid the Germans would bomb Columbia or something. They put them in Chicago.
Oh, that's why this went to the stadium.
Stadium.
That was the Manhattan Project.
Manhattan Project.
Did that started here, and then they moved it
here,
to Chicago?
That's called the Manhattan Project.
Sure. I didn't realize that.
All the top physicists were involved. Oppenheimer. Now, Oppenheimer was not a great physicist. He was a great organizer.
Mm-hmm.
Teller, Oppenheimer, and Schwinger and so on. Schwinger didn't want to become involved in that. He didn't want to do that. Yes. Feynman became, they all did.
What do you think about the theory that discovery, that ability to create a fission bomb was at a time that humanity hadn't really got a hold of its, somebody likened it to a, said it's like a toddler has got a hold of a meat cleaver and he's waving it over his head. He may drop it on the deck or he may drop it right through his skull. And they think, people think that maybe it came too soon to us because we didn't have the social or political ability to handle it.
You remember, this was a period of the Nazis.
That's true.
And war was there. And the Japanese, this is a triple state, there's triple Nazi, what is it, Italy?
Sure, the Axis.
And Japan.
Right.
We were, because we're a two-ocean nation, we had to worry about Japan on the Pacific. We had to worry about the Nazis, so that it was necessary for us to be able to tackle all of these things. It's a complicated situation, you see. And on, if you go to channel, I think it's channel 17, the History Channel, every now and then they go back to these things, and it's horrifying to see how people, and even now they're banging each other. What the hell is going on in
Kosovo?
What are they doing? What do they want?
Well, that's my point I wanted to bring up, is are we socially and politically mature enough to handle things like not only fission bombs, but fusion bombs, the hydrogen bomb and things like that? Or is there such a deep will to survive in humanity that we will override narrow national interests and not
deep will is
to ourselves? You think?
Sure.
That's an optimistic view.
In a sense, I believe that Marx's idea of a universal society is correct. We cannot live independently of the what's going on in the rest of the world, and more that's happening, you see. Reagan referred to the, Ronald Reagan, to the Soviet Union at the time as the evil empire.
Yeah, I remember.
The evil at that time were the Nazis. And the fact that the Soviet Union organized troops and came in and defeated the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And then met the Americans, they shook hands, and they were so-and-so.
Now, the Nazi era was so horrible, we tended to think, well, that almost couldn't happen in the 20th century, and it was just a one-shot thing, it will never happen again. Now we see with this ethnic cleansing, we see in the Yugoslavia area, that wasn't an unusual thing, unfortunately. It seems to be deep in human nature, every now and then pops out. The idea of trying to justify genocide. What hope is there in the future now for us to outgrow that?
Well, I think what we have to develop more and more is a sense of children. I'm what is known as a childaholic. I'm at Columbia and I watch parents and there's a carriage with a child. I have to stop and give the child my finger. It begins to... and caress it and so on. I can't avoid it. I really can't avoid it. And you have to love children, no matter who they are. And I see pictures, sometimes they show on TV, a poor little girl somewhere, I don't know where, and I weeping and so on.
I hate to see that. Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Well, you're an aficionado of life, I think, is what it amounts to. And that might Does that make you optimistic or pessimistic about our future?
I'm pretty optimistic about it. Because why was there life to begin with? Nature meant something. If we recall way just a few thousand years ago, there were no civilizations. There were no continents. Who was around at that time? Of course, it started with the flight of the Jews from Egypt, but there was no Europe. There were no countries. And if you go from the countries around the equator upwardly, why were black skins developed? The black skin is a defense because the light is absorbed, the photons preventing the radiation from affecting the skin. If you go further and further north, you get whiter and whiter. So a little bit is about white and black and Ku Klux, all that horrible thing.
Yeah.
And there's still the Klan idea, the Ku Klux Klan, still is. There are problems going on.
Yeah, why do people have such trouble for races to get along? Richard Leakey advanced a theory some time ago that racial differences are something that flit across the surface of human time in roughly 15,000-year cycles, which makes it almost nothing compared to... And he said, you know, 15,000 years from now, if we still have different races, they'll be different from any of the races we have now. And 30,000 years...
It may well be you, but you must recall now that we're dealing with a situation where most of the civilizations occurred in the Northern Hemisphere. And if you look at the Northern Hemisphere and you look at as though we're a jigsaw puzzle, they all collected around the North Pole. And for some thing or other, there was a drift of the continents down and a breaking up, probably arising in the deep oceans in some way. So you had Europe on one side, European countries, and then the North American. After all, when was North America populated? Only when first landing in Virginia, what was it, the Plymouth Rock? I don't know. I forgot what.
Well, as far as civilized nations coming from Europe, yes. Sure. Some people came across the Bering Land Bridge earlier, but that was geologically very, very recent, I realize. Wasn't Wegener was laughed at for his idea of continental drift theory, and then they finally had to admit that was happening in this.
Right, so.
Apparently these blobs of granitic rock floating in a sea of basaltic rock, if it weren't for that difference, we would be covered to an even depth of water.
We are lucky here in New York because we can't get earthquakes. We're at the very oldest rocks that are so firm.
And that's why we don't have earthquakes here of any significance. That's interesting.
And I have developed the idea of predicting an earthquake by what is known as a piezoelectric effect. In other words, if you squeeze a crystal, then you separate the electrons and you should be able to detect faults. You would have to sink their tectonic plates. The continents are floating on tectonic plates, and you have to sink electrodes, metal, all the way down, and you detect voltage differences. And you could even draw electricity out of it, and you get electricity by the energy being transmitted.
Yes. Does that account for... I read one time that may account for peculiar behavior of animals just before an earthquake, that they sense that...
They seem to sense it, but we don't know why.
Yeah.
They probably do.
If that's the case, that would fit some scientific theory. It's not just a...
I develop theories at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
it's interesting.
You're famous for that. Do you think on the future, though, of knowledge about this, the whole universe that we live in, it seems so much more vast than it was a while back. It must have been more comforting to people in the days when they thought the earth was flat and that heaven was right above them and maybe hell right beneath them, but it was all earth-centered, and now that's all been taken away from us by our knowledge of the universe.
We look at another star, stars near us, let's say 9 light years away, and we find that these stars should be, relative to us, they should be in a not moving in any way, an inertial frame, and yet they seem to be wobbling. We argue then, this may arise because they have planets going around them. Nobody's ever discovered a planet. But
not that they can see, no.
There's no reason why there shouldn't be planets. But.
Do you think we will ever advance enough telescopically that we would be able to resolve a planet on a distant star
into a dish. If you make a very large opening of a telescope, then there's a Rayleigh disk, which you cannot, in other words, nature prevents, when the light comes in, it's supposed to come in and converge at a certain point. That is true if you are dealing just with light without an oscillation, just a straight. But if it's fluctuating, then the light is no longer be able to concentrate in a point, mm-hmm. so that you get a disturbance, which...
Yeah, I think at Mount Wilson now, they're working on adaptive optics that will handle that on a computer basis and take the twinkle out of the stars, which makes some of the ground-based telescopes potentially as accurate as the Hubble in space.
I believe that our mind is such that we can develop anything. That accounts, for example, Gates' development of the soft... Yeah. This guy made billions of dollars. And that is nothing more than opening windows to various things that we weren't aware of. You now can press a button and you're going to get a stream of information to you.
Sure.
And when I talk about information, I say to myself, where can you find the greatest concentration of information? So I eat an apple and I find a seed. Mm-hmm. I said, that seed contains a vast amount of information. Yeah. From it, that information contains how the roots will grow, how the tree will grow, how in one little seed, we can't match that.
No, but do you think computer technology will ever tap that so that we'll be down at the molecular level of storage and retrieval and maybe use DNA or something for our computers?
Don't know. I thought at one time maybe I should take an apple seed and a pear seed and see if I can combine them. To form a
piece of fruit that's a combination.
I think that's...
Yeah.
Look, there's no limit to what we can do. It's wonderful.
There probably is no foreseeable limit. And if we've got a lot of time before the sun swells into a red giant, there may be things we can't even imagine that we will do in the future.
Yeah.
If we don't do ourselves in some way, and then...
Sure, that the way that. It is with a lead teller and others to the hydrogen bomb, you see, instead of the uranium bomb, because they realize they can get energy if you combine protons and neutrons to form helium. Mm-hmm. You see, the total mass of helium is less than the mass of when two things combine to form a small structure, they have to give up energy.
And give up energy.
That's
all
right.
Now tell me, what do you think about cold fusion and all
that's come up recently. Yeah. Let us suppose I have a combination of neutrons and so on in a container, you see. And I'm going to compress them adiabatically without letting heat escape. I shouldn't be able to force them to such a point that they begin to combine with each other and release energy. So this piston will be pushed back. I have another piston on this side doing the same thing so I can get it.
And okay.
It goes back and forth infinitely.
But that takes enormous energy, doesn't it, to compress them
well,
to that point?
Well, because there's pressure against it. But it forces the particles inside to move around rapidly. They start combining. Right. They're bound to.
Okay.
Even if only two combine, then until the piston can't go any further until more and more combine, then they push the piston back into another region.
Now, that combining is happening in the interior of the sun, isn't it?
That's right.
Where you've got a lot of heat along with the pressure.
You have protons being changed to helium in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's believed the sun ultimately will cool off.
So it'll lose all the hydrogen and the helium, and I suppose by the time it gets past iron, or what is it?
Because to go beyond iron, you have to add energy.
Mm-hmm.
To obtain heavier nuclei. And that's the point. That is, everything tends to go to the lowest energy state.
Right.
It's like walking along a flat plateau and there's a hole. You fall into the hole. You see, you can't go any further. That's it. You give up all your energy.
How do some large stars become novae and supernovae?
That's not quite understood, but it is possibly because they've used up all the energy at the interior, they have to collapse.
And when they collapse
they release a vast amount of energy in that way.
Is that mostly in the form of neutrons? Not neutron, neutrinos?
Neutrinos probably come out. The neutrino hasn't been understood, and I think physicists have gone to incredible states. They speak up of the electron neutrino, the proton neutrino, all kinds. Yeah. I argue there's only one kind of neutrino. Why do we need them all?
Yeah, so you think there is only one.
And I find objections in my statement. One neutrino will do it.
Yeah.
That's the point.
That's interesting. Do you think that among quarks, unless there aren't quarks, and if your theory of unitons might replace that if you in your scheme, do you think that maybe ultimately there's only one kind of quark?
Well, there must be a simplest particle. That's all I can say. Nothing below that. We must begin with the idea that nature gave us the simplest possible thing. And I argue the quark is that particle. Otherwise, we'd have to picture a universe with nothing in it.
Well, is that an endless process, possibly? Because we had originally the word atom means indivisible, and then we found that it was there were particles in that, and then subatomic particles.
Sure, of course.
Is that something that might not have an end as far as we know?
No, but then you'd end with nothing. I don't think something can be produced from nothing.
No.
Right. That's the point.
I see. And that relates to your uniton idea, I guess. And the idea of a cold universe as opposed to a cold start as opposed to a hot Big Bang.
Yes, I think it's cold. I think that's more sensible because when they spoke of the Big Bang, where was the Big Bang? They say the Big Bang created the universe, but if there's no universe, where was the Big Bang?
Yeah, that's
more sensible.
We always think of the Big Bang as something you look at happen out there, but
no,
there was no out
let's
there.
Let's suppose you that. You don't know there's a box somewhere. You don't know the box. But then you see boards flying in all directions. You suspect that dynamite exploded inside. That's my picture.
But if it's true that time and space and energy all were created at the moment of the Big Bang, then the idea of talking about what happened before the Big Bang is as senseless as saying, how do you go north of the North Pole?
That's right.
It would have been... again, either from a singularity, which seems unlikely with those unwanted infinities.
Well, the questions you ask indicates that you've learned a hell of a lot.
Well,
a hell of a lot.
The more I learn, the more questions there are.
Of course,
you get it just seems that way. But that makes it a fascinating challenge, I think, to try to keep up with. And I stand in awe of some of the things that have been discovered already. Incidentally, your book on the universe and its origin and fate is still, in my mind, one of the very good texts on that subject.
I try to write everything as simply as possible and never assume that the student... And so I just happened to reread one of the books I wrote, The Essentials of Astronomy, and I was amazed. I said, well, how could I have done all this writing? I never typed. I would do it longhand and then have it. Then the two-volume book, The World of the Atom, two volumes, where I discuss not only the atomic structure, but also the story of the lives. And then another book, Atomic Scientist, in which I discuss Feynman and Fermi. Well, I worked with Fermi in a lot of things. So I did a lot of writing.
Yeah. And you write in longhand?
That's right.
Well, you and Tolstoy. I guess we're going to
give
pieces.
It to a typist. That's why I had there's one woman who typed for me. I've forgotten her name now. She did the typing. And then Weaver did the typing. So I put their names on it for some reason. They never contributed anything to it. But.
To review about you, you are basically optimistic, but you're realistic also. You seem to be have an endless curiosity about the world, and that doesn't diminish apparently with the fact that you've put in a lot of years now learning and teaching, and you're still curious about.
I'm going to be 90, Hugh.
Are you only 90? Is that
that's right? June 5th.
Is that right? Because I remember 42 years ago when you were teaching at the School of General Studies, and I was during the International Geophysical Year. And the concept of neutrinos was sort of new then, as I recall.
Well, the neutrino that's Fermi introduced the neutrino. You see, suppose you have a nucleus which decays.
Right.
And you see electrons coming out. sometimes the electrons come out slowly, sometimes they come out rapidly. So Fermi said, that can't be. The energy difference between this step and that is fixed.
Yes.
So how can, if an electron comes out with a given amount of energy, it must equal that energy, but some electrons come out like sluggards, very slowly. Therefore, another particle has to come out very rapidly, neutrino.
And that was the beginning of neutrino. What year was that he came up with that?
I've forgotten the date of it, but all you need to do is go back to Fermi, who got the Nobel Prize in 1939 and had to leave Italy because the Nazis were coming in and his wife is Jewish.
So, oh, and that's when...
She wrote a book, Laura Fermi, that's her name. Adams, she called it Adams and the Family. She wrote a book, very interesting. Lovely woman.
But how did he sense that the neutrino, apparently almost all matter in the universe is virtually transparent to a neutrino, where a photon is stopped right away by...
Well, that's a very interesting point, which I've been thinking about recently. The photon is a vibrating thing and must be related to a vibrating field, which is the electromagnetic field, electricity, magnetism. Neutrino doesn't vibrate, it just moves. That must be associated with a field that doesn't, so it's a gravity.
Gravity, that's
the point. Neutrinos to gravity as photon is to electromagnetism.
Oh, that's what you meant by that.
Now, people have rejected that. Some people introduced three or four different kinds of neutrinos. I said, what for? Why don't you simplify things? What's the point of introducing?
You don't think you need the different kinds?
I don't think you need it. Neutrinos are everywhere. They pass right through you, all over the place here. We don't know. So.
Yeah, they can go through the sun without slowing up, as I understand it.
There's no way to slow down a neutrino, as far as we know.
Yeah. Does that make a potential for an oscillating neutrino beam? By that I mean where you could put a frequency on it and do communications right through the crust of the Earth.
It might possibly so, yes. You could introduce a language to the neutrino, you might be able to communicate with the Chinese instantaneously.
Right down through the...
I think in time we will learn that. Now, imagine falling through a hole, in a hole all the way from the Earth down to China.
Yeah.
What would happen? You'd fall, and you'd speed up. But then on the other side, you'd have to slow down, so you'd be oscillating back and forth.
Yeah.
Get the point? But if you try to dig a hole, then the pressure would close the hole. If you try to dig a hole in the ground, so you'd have to be able to... I've introduced also a very interesting idea. Let us suppose you could erect huge poles, metal poles, high up above the Earth, and put cars along there, which would ride along the wires. Mm-hmm. It'd be an equipotential surface. They'd rise up here and then move along here and move along here, so we could travel from one place to another without having to fly. I mean, of course, today we fly, which is a much easier thing.
Oh, in more or less straight lines, you're coming closer to the Earth and then going farther away and so forth. I don't know. With atmospheric drag might be a factor then, unless the poles were very high.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting idea.
Well, I like to think of all these things simply because I say, is it possible?
Sure.
And so I keep my mind active in that way. And even in at home living, you try to do things. You have a dishwasher. Now, how do you? In other words, can you do it in a simpler way and so on?
And that's the nature of invention, I guess.
That's right.
It's been said that necessity is the mother of invention, but I don't think all inventions have to come from a necessity. They come from a desire to make life a little easier or to do something a shorter, more efficient way. And almost every invention that's of a practical use makes you think, why didn't I think of that?
That's quite true.
But you spend some time thinking of those things.
How
much longer do you think you'll go on teaching at Columbia, or do you
plan
to
retire? Well, I'm a professor emeritus now,
right.
So of course, I just consult with students on that.
I see.
I don't teach anymore.
So you don't go to classes and things like that.
So, but Well, Columbia's been available. I mean, my office is kept open, the kitchen, I have secretarial help, anything I want done. That's it.
Terrific. That's so, terrific. I've had you must have some interesting consultations.
It's been what they call a wonderful life. Isn't there a film that was recently?
There was a film some time ago called A Wonderful Life. Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Stewart, was that right?
Yeah, Jimmy Stewart did that. That's right. Yeah. And a recent Oscar winner was a thing called Life is Beautiful.
Life is Beautiful, I think was the name of that. Yes.
A surprise.
Are you involved at all in films or?
No, I've not. Television has been, and radio has been my entire career, but my basic interests, I think, are have to do with science and medicine.
I've interest in everything. For example, I was reading some material which appeared in Nature on the skin. Yeah. That if you stretch the skin, it prevents wrinkles.
Oh, really? I thought that was supposed to create wrinkles.
No, it's stretching the skin.
If it stays stretched, but if it loses elasticity, you're going to...
Yeah. Because then I said, well, why should that be? And they discovered that the cells in the skin, individual cells, are separated from each other by elastic structures. And so I said, well, why not massage the skin in such a way that you stretch it? And you should be able to prevent wrinkling.
To help preserve the elasticity then? Is that what I've always wondered, when you can put a dent in your skin with a fingernail, and the dent is there for a while, but the skin has some kind of memory that knows where it's supposed to be, and
that's
the dent
right.
disappears. Why is that?
Well, that we don't know.
The
body is so complicated. Yeah. The bone structure. What keeps the bones together?
What do you think is a bigger challenge, finding out ultimate truths about a theory of everything, about the universe itself, or learning about physiology and the complicated nature
That'll
of the human?
That'll be more complicated. My son Robin is a professor of medicine and he's sent me a number of books. And I look up, for example, I have a knee injury, let's say. I look up the knees, God, what's going on?
Isn't that a complicated thing? Yes,
it's so complicated.
Fantastic.
Absolutely complicated.
Well, this has been a marvelous session. I really enjoy talking to you, as you know.
Thank you very much.
And I sure thank you for contributing to this. And I'll look forward to, I'll see you, of course, in May at the dinner, if not before. And I thank you for a really pleasant hour.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.